Okay, sorry for the late start. I'm just going to talk for a couple of minutes to try to give context to this panel. I think the title may be a bit misleading. It's really the trying to think about ways where artists and specifically, you know, some people will talk specifically about streaming art and the issue of funding. People have to pay rent and pay for their food, and especially with the fact that there isn't much government support for the arts in places like the United States, for example. There's a little bit of more of a tradition for that in Europe. Other artists have to have regular jobs, and then after they finish from their daily work, they go and work on their art. So they sort of have two jobs, one that they do just for the sake of money, and the other they do for because they want to do it. And for me, it's somewhat of a, I think, a philosophical issue, because I think it's the idea that work should be something that people enjoy, and artistic creation, and people by their own nature are creators. People should not be forced to work all day without doing things that they don't enjoy, and artists should be compensated in somehow for their creative work. There are commercial models, of course, especially on the internet, for how artists can, you know, can sell their work for advertisers, for example. There's also value issues. Can art be something that is commodified? Is art something that you take and you sell? And there's also art as performance versus art as something that can be copied a million times, and through that process of copying, you make money through copyright, etc. So I'm going to start by introducing David Guez from Teleweb. David lives in Paris, France, and he started a project a couple of years ago called Teleweb.
This one 6 months ago, but
yeah,
I did do
TV
media project for a couple.
Yeah, and it's you know, basically a sort of a web a video portal to allow people to publish their own video pieces online. Also, David is working on a media lab in Paris. So I let him keep on with the introduction. So here you go.
Hello. Thank you. yes, I just okay. So, as a French artist, I have lots of things to say about the subject of this talking. Maybe what I want to begin to say it's as an artist working on the net, on internet, I try to do some works which, in a way, fight with the commercial things. So it's the beginning of the problems, in a way. Because, for example, with teleweb.org, I did a website which, in a way, looked like a very famous commercial site in France, which is Canal Web, which is also showing some movies of people and everything. And I did the kind, little bit the same, but in a free access and in a public access. So in a way, I'm a competitor with them. I just say that now to say later that, of course, I refuse money from them then. It's the object. What I want to say, in France, we normally have money from the government. So when you make an art project, you can ask for money. But there is lots of problems because 2 years ago, or even until now, people from the government don't understand the internet and what's going on internet. So you can't talk to anybody to explain what you do. So they don't give you money then, because they don't understand that it's art project and how it works and so. So there is a structural problems with this. So this is one thing. I don't know here how it works, but I think in every country it's different. The second problem, it's when you do artwork on internet, especially such artwork which never ending. I mean, it's always growing, and it's working also with the structural things of internet. Can you sell it as an object, as a painting, as a sculpture, or is it like performance? In fact, you can't sell a performance. You can't So it's so you have this problem also, and also the idea of internet with the copyleft attitude. I don't know if you know what is it. It's something to say that if you do artwork, you can duplicate it, you can give it to some other person, and so on and so on. So in a way or in another way, if you do a project, there is a problem with the company. I mean, the company comes to you and says, okay, your project is great, we want to buy it. And this company, Canal Web, offered me $1 million to buy this project. And of course, I refuse because I'm dealing with this. So it's so my problem as an artist now is I have to work next to it to make it work. And maybe I will talk later about other problems in France. There is no specific place to work to make your art project with internet and so on. So it's also the same. I'm doing everything in my kitchen with my computer. And well, it's okay. It's nice, huh? But it's just to fix the problem. That's it. Yeah, we and later with this.
All right. Now I'm introducing Joe Pizzillo. Joe Pizzillo is the founder of Go Gaga. It's an internet radio station that started. Maybe you want to.
Sure. Yeah. Let me.
Internet radio station based in Colorado in the United States, and they do they bring DJs and they do their own some of their own mixes, and they have, you know, maybe 12 or, I don't know, 20 different channels of different kinds of music. Joe Pizzillo is an entrepreneur as well as an artist, and so he's going to be talking about that aspect.
There you go. Hopefully this will come up in a second. Go Gaga started almost exactly 4 years ago. The company was founded in October of 1996. We put Go Gaga on the air originally April 1st of 1997. The company, the idea behind Go Gaga was originally my background is in public radio, community radio in Boulder, Colorado, where I was a volunteer on air for about a decade. I worked in the high-tech industry. I worked for Apple Computer for 3 years, and as part of that, did a lot of traveling around the country in the United States to other high-tech companies, and was constantly startled to find people a lot like all of us sitting at computers with headphones on and large stacks of CDs next to their computers that were very eclectic. They would have rock and roll and jazz and electronic music and maybe even some classical music and so on, which is exactly the kind of radio tradition that I had come from, a free-form radio tradition. Likewise, traveling the United States quite a bit, and I've heard similar stories from around the world, radio is terrible. Radio is awful. Radio is just the same limited playlist all day long, intense commercial loads these days. In the United States, sometimes playing as much as 20 minutes per hour of commercials. And it was clear to me that the audience that was similar to you know, the internet generation audience, if you will, was not being served by commercial radio. And here was an opportunity because everyone was at a computer, because people were using, you know, had a broadband connection through their office, to create radio that spoke more to that audience, that spoke specifically to the internet audience. So we started Go Gaga with the idea that it would be a freeform channel. You'll see that freeform is still one of our highlighted channels and still our most popular channel. And we played a mix of music that was, you know, extremely eclectic. We had a daytime program called Music for Cubicles, which spoke to people working in their office, ostensibly sitting inside of a little cubicle and, you know, having the man to deal with and so on and so forth. So our DJs would come on and sort of dispel the myth or the mystique of the DJ because they were human beings. They were real people. And we spent a very small amount of money. We were a bootstrap company. We talked to venture capitalists on day one, and many of them said, you know, I'm just hearing about the internet, and now you're talking about internet radio. I don't know what you're talking about, but have fun. And so that's what we did. We went out and we tried to have a good time. We had DJs, as was mentioned, come in across a variety of different genres of music. We had electronic music DJs. We had reggae DJs. We have DJs playing obscure classic or vintage music, as well as industrial music and so on and so forth. And 3 years later, after we'd spent less than $500,000, we realized that this was expensive. And we had competitors like Spinner, who had been bought by America Online, Net Radio, which had gone public, was being publicly traded in the market. and other competitors being bought and essentially getting larger than we were. And so we were left in this position of being essentially a fringe or outside kind of product that wasn't commercial radio like some of these competitors, but at the same time being a little, you know, too big to stay fully underground and stay we're still independent, so I don't want to say not independent, but to stay below the radar. For our long-term success depended on us being able to break out of being essentially a small product and move into this higher category. And we were pretty successful at doing that, I would say, with the exception of the fact that there's still not a huge advertising base for streaming media. You read about it quite a bit, that streaming advertising, internet advertising obviously has grown quite a bit. Streaming media is supposed to be very popular and successful. However, the actual dollars in terms of the cost of production are still not there. So to produce a site like GoGaga, in the early days, we got to the point where it was costing us in the neighborhood of about, I would say, $30,000 a month. And that was with a lot of material being given to us at almost no cost or extremely low cost. A lot of the equipment being used secondhand, free network connection, free preset from real networks in their player. So we'd achieved a lot of things on a very low cost, and yet still with the labor and some of the other expenses, pardon me, we were running about $30,000 a month. And all we were was frustrated. All we had was frustration that we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that, we couldn't afford this, we couldn't afford that. We basically were only able to keep the thing going at that rate. So we raised some venture capital money last year. As part of that, some traditional radio people got involved with the company. And we consolidated our products under the brand GoGaga. We previously, some people might know, we'd done a variety of different channels, turned that all into GoGaga, and then added some things that are a little more commercial in nature, things like adult hits or classic rock and some other channels that we wouldn't necessarily have pursued as this alternative thing. Now, that said, we're also able to do things like create a channel around the artist Ammon Tobin, who's a relatively well-known electronic music artist. So we have been able to do both more mainstream and more alternative types of products with some of the financing. At the same time, however, the advertising revenue did not like miraculously appear out of thin air. So the fundamental model, advertising supported media, I think is still valid. However, I'm not sure, it may be a little sort of cart before the horse issue right now in that the market is still relatively young. The number of people who are using streaming media, although ever growing, is comparatively small, especially in any given market. One of the other things that we're doing now is focusing on doing more geographic products. We've recently introduced a version of GoGaga or versions of GoGaga for the Denver market, which is the geographic market that we're based in, which allows us to do better marketing. We can just drive to venues. We can drive to where people are. We have a relationship with the Denver Post, which is the largest newspaper in Denver, which has allowed us to have marketing presence, promotional presence in the newspaper to take advantage of the editorial content that the newspaper provides, and also, of course, to use the sales force that they've got. So you'll see as this page loads that we do have headlines from the newspaper and some things like that. So part of what we're doing now is moving the commercial, or moving the what was essentially an artistic model or an alternative model to begin with into the mainstream in a couple of different ways, and in part using a relatively large partner, a relatively powerful partner to do so. And you'll see that, you know, now on this Denver channel even, we offer things like, this is a very eclectic channel based on our freeform format, classical music, of which there's no current radio station in the Denver market that offers that, a mainstream rock format, a reggae format, and then a sort of hits format. And I'll be happy to talk about details of financing or how, you know, expenses related to this, so that you can understand where our model comes from. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Okay, moving on to Raoul Canemier. I don't know if I'm saying it right. Yeah, from Boombox in Switzerland, which is an internet radio station also, but non-for-profit. Mm-hmm. So I'll let you explain probably better than me. So.
Okay, I will start shortly by going back also, because I think it's a part of an evolution in terms of finding how can I fund my projects or the things I actually, things you do, you have fun with, and you know, they cost money on one point. When we started, me and my partner with Web Publishing, summer in 95, naturally not many people were doing it. And it was very, very interesting. In those days, we were working in a cultural center in Zurich, Switzerland, where, of course, we were confronted with music, artists, subsidies from the governments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we also tried to, we actually started on that base, on that model, and one of the first realizations where Boombox actually evolved from, that was a cultural club network called Hugo.ch, where the idea was to bind cultural clubs in Switzerland together on a platform, so they could have their own homepages, their own FTP access, their own email, kind of providing them the tools together to explore this new medium and see what kind of meaning it could bring for cultural centers per se. So we launched that summer end of 95, and we had a virtual hosting first. Naturally, we thought we want to give accounts to the people. The platform actually was also open for bands, so any band could submit their materials, their AU file, IEFF files, whatever it was in that days. And naturally, we needed a server. And in relation to this conference, there come the first subsidy from our part that requested at an institution in Zurich that's called the PopCredit, the money to buy a server. So that was quite interesting because the first time they were confronted with it, although there were some other organizations also flying around in these days, or internet activists, so to say. Some of you will know, like eToy, for example, they were also Zurich-based. So we started looking for funding for our ideas and our projects, of which Hugo was one of the first. Now, Hugo.ch still exists. It's still running. Artists have accounts. Bands have accounts. Clubs have accounts. This thing is really running by itself, as it was meant to be, actually, in our idea of a kind of decentralized promotion mechanism for cultural centers. We were actually we were booking bands for this cultural center, so we had access to the artists. And knowing, as a lot of people know, there's a lot of stuff going on in these clubs, which are really, really interesting, known acts, but also less known acts. And our experience that we were gathering by working with the medium, by working with the internet, actually brought us with the idea we have to also keep something of the experience what we have. If we have a club night on a Friday night or a Saturday night, usually you just walk out with the memory and there's, furthermore, there's not much left. It's of course interesting, but there's a lot of people who do not know what is going on, what this music means or what it does. From this core idea, actually, we could say Boombox evolved. And we started webcasting. We bought the first real audio server, which we actually had to buy with our own money. From that regard, it was over $1,000, and it was a 5-user license. So don't tell me they're expensive now, okay? And so we bought the server, which we shared also with other people. Specifically in that time, there was a lot of sharing going on also, exactly like guys like eToy, et cetera, because we were all having a feeling we were really developing something. And defining something too. So we started webcasting bands on the internet. So first with Real Audio 1, and then we wanted a visual with it, so we started experimenting. A nice anecdote is that we were running around with Polaroids on the stage, and then there was one person, usually me, sitting on the side of the stage with a scanner and scan these things in, and then we had a Perl server push that would like push these images to whoever was connected in these days. So that was really, really interesting. And later we had, webcams came in, et cetera, et cetera, and the internet started getting momentum. We had more requirements, hardware requirements, time requirements, et cetera, et cetera, and we were confronted with the same issues. We have had funding from the government. On one point, you kind of outgrow this funding, so to say, and you have to look for different means. Specifically when the internet really started to take off in Switzerland, based on the experience, naturally, that we gathered by working with the medium, it was not really hard for us to maintain ourselves in terms of work and our private lives and such. And we needed to look for, but we needed a way to support Boombox or continue with Boombox. Now, let's say around 98, we did several visits also to more commercially oriented companies like Pseudo.com or SonicNet, or SonicNet launched, and around this time based on the first real video release. They made streamland.com, so they were streaming video clips online. And we were very interested in that, so we went to visit them. And naturally, we're also playing with the ideas for Boombox. Yeah. We can sell advertising, we can do sponsoring, we can do in-stream ads, and you know, we can write business plans of 30, 40, 50 pages. And before we know it, you know, we're launched and we're up there. You know. So that was one possibility. We did not take this possibility. Because one thing we enjoy about Boombox, it's open, it's not for profit. We have permission of the artists, the management, the record companies to publish these materials. It's also open for local artists. We did a variety of local shows also with people in Zurich on a weekly basis. This was around 97, 98. And we decided we want to keep it like this. So if we need to fund this one way or another, we naturally have to move on anyways. And the model we chose for is that, together with my partner Laurence, we created a company, Nomad Media Corporation, and the knowledge we have and we have gathered over the years, we are actually selling to corporations, ISPs, telcos, whoever is in need of streaming media services, database development, client-side scripting, server-side scripting, whatever. And this enables us to keep the project open, to keep it for free, to not use any advertising. And until now, we do not regret this. Also, because there is no pressure behind it. If we would have done a model, an advertising-based model or whatever, you need to live up to the expectations. If we would do a VZ model, we have to live up to the expectations, et cetera, et cetera. Now for us, we work a lot. For us, it's fun. We know the acts come. We go in the evening, we go out, we go to the clubs, we connect over the ISDN, and we start broadcasting these shows, and we got free beers, so that's great. That's a little bit the Boombox story. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Well, next is Vikram Krishna, who is from Bombay, India, I believe. And Vikram has been working with in the industry for over 20 years and is interested in developing communication, radio specific, I believe, website and using the internet for that, and has some really interesting ideas about funding and commercial model and etc. So, you introduce yourself and.
Okay. Yeah, right. So, actually, my partner Arun Mehta and I, we've been busy for the last year in trying to put together audio-centric solutions that will be very applicable for countries like India to get internet access to people who today don't have telephones, but many of them have got cable TV. You know, I looked at this panel in a different light, really. There are things that are happening all around us and many interesting things happening in India. I'd like to touch on one or two of them during the course of this little introduction. But I just want to step back a little bit. You know, I think around the turn of the century, we saw with technology bringing in new forms of recording art, such as, for instance, what we call records or music, you know, archives, in forms like the wax cylinder originally, and then vinyl finally, through a process, I mean, in between there was shellac, and then finally it went to vinyl. And later on it came to cassette tapes and CDs and so on. What this did, in my opinion, what this did was the industry constrained the art form to fit into the form that was available because the medium was such. Because the medium was, you know, a long playing record or something, so you could have 12 songs of 3 minutes each, and there became a huge genre of 3 minute songs. You know, the rest of the music took a back seat. Classical music, which was the big music of the previous century, took a real back seat, and this music came in. Jazz, which should have been long pieces, became short pieces. Classical music, which was long pieces, hardly got a foot in at all in many of these media, and so on. But I don't want to spend too much time on that. That's really history. What's happening today, as I see it, is with the internet, that form at least is broken. Along with the form being broken, to my mind, the equally important thing is that the distribution form is also being changed. When you had physical records, you had to have a physical delivery infrastructure, logistics, and all that to get the songs to people where they could finally buy them. I'm talking about songs only as just because I happen to have a particular interest in music. But of course, this applies in different ways to other forms of art as well, paintings and so on, with their gallery infrastructure and all that. With the internet, this is getting broken. It now means that artists have an opportunity to create their own new models, paradigms which we've been listening to, three different examples already we've heard, of where art forms are beginning to reach the consumer without the complex infrastructure, the distribution and marketing channels that today, as a friend of ours in India, when he releases a CD, plays in a band and he releases a CD, so the cost of the CD may be around 250 rupees, he gets 30 rupees out of that, okay? That's the royalties earned with the whole, intellectual properties right kind of paradigm and all that sort of stuff. And this, right or wrong, it's certainly not very pleasant for the artist. Here's an opportunity for this to change, and I think along with the examples you've already heard and with the example that you see in other places, let me just actually take this time to mention a couple of things that are happening in India. Art exchanges are coming up. I know at least two websites in India which are running art exchanges. Their models for earning artists' money from their creations are different from what we've seen earlier. There's a lot of talk about renting art. There's a lot of talk about making art available for a particular period contract. So, say, corporates who like to hang up art in the foyer and so on, they can buy art for a year or 2 years instead of being stuck with a whole investment arm like Bill Gates, running and deciding whether he wants to buy big art and become a big art owner, that sort of thing. So very interesting, I think, that this sort of stuff is happening even in India. India does not have a history of the state supporting art in a big way. There are some state funding routes, but they're not at all important in a country our size. Other than that, it's direct purchase. So I think that I just want to close here by saying that there are a lot of new opportunities, and it's up to us really to create ones that are meaningful in each geospecific area and even larger than that. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, I'll introduce Mike Raymel from Club Radio, which is based in Berlin, also with Border 2000. Club Radio does really interesting stuff around club culture in Berlin and has some interesting ways of raising money and paying the artists for DJs for their work, I think. So if you want to talk about what you do at Club Radio.
Yeah, I can present that, I think. Hello. Club Radio started in 98, but it has a background, and I want to talk at least two sentences about the background of the people doing it. Club Radio is broadcasting live from clubs. It's a broadcaster. Our interest in clubs is very diverse, I would say. I start with me being the donkey, I guess. I start with me. I did a diploma work as an economics student for a sociologist that was concerned about the change of music market and the change of music sociology, basically. Over the last decade, I would call it, and it was a rather wide approach to see what's there around progressive music-centered subcultures and what delivery forms have developed, the labels, the media, the festivals, the places where events are happening, and where is it going to go to? Like, how does the internet affect the whole process of production and distribution of progressive styles? I'm interested in progressive styles, I'm sorry. But you could apply that to any kind of progressive style. It doesn't have to be music, it doesn't have to be, could be books, could be anything, could be text. So that's my background, to kind of try to see as a fan, as a DJ, the sociological approach, the scene approach to music, being a fan-driven person, on the other hand, having the tools of economics, thinking abstractly about distribution forms, about models of pricing, about business ideas. So the rest of our team is a very interesting structure too. I mean, Tomas Kallmann is our technician. Most of you might know him. He's doing projects like Radio Internationale Stadt, orangorang.org, which is a real audio music archive. I guess it's for QuickTime also. He also programmed the OVA, the Open Video Archive, which is an open video archive that you can use for archiving and broadcasting just by writing an email there. Now he recently brought out the Open Meta Archive, the OMA, which is an archive that is encompassing all the different possible content formats. So he's a specialist in database programming and in Unix and Linux, and he's a net artist, I would call it, an early net artist, a pioneer, which was very helpful in the process of opening our basic infrastructure, which is connecting four clubs. It used to be 8 dance floors. At the moment, it's 6 dance floors. It's going to be more dance floors soon. Sustainable growth is one of the ingredients for, I would say, making money or the possibility of making money. So that's Tomas Kallmann as a second member in the team. Pitt Schultz, that you might have heard here on the panels, has a very strong background in net critique, critical approaches in the net, possibilities deriving from technical possibilities for social spaces, for environmental spaces, for political systems, I guess. He was one of the founders of NetTime.org and is really strongly involved in audio on the net via the Net Radio Days that they organized in 98 with the Micro e.V. in Berlin, which was rather influential, I guess, for many people. The exchange connection is a very, very good backup and very thoughtful backup also. So there's a fourth person, that's Guido Plonsky, who is a rather straight businessman who likes music but who doesn't care too much about scenes. That's not his topic. He's like more like a real straight business man. We're talking about the art of making money, and the art of making money, I think, has to do with something like cooking. It's like you have a lot of parameters, you have a lot of features that you can put together and arrange them differently. There's a vast amount of approaches we are having been presented here in Amsterdam, which is very helpful, I think, to see what other people are doing and what's possible on the market. And I mean, we're talking about regional markets, international markets, and also maybe personal markets. I mean, art is always about an artist, and that's normally one person. Sometimes it's a group, which could be a band. Sometimes it's a community or a tribe, maybe, that produces things. So we're basically talking about individuals. So which leads me to another point, which is, I think, important in the whole process of producing and distributing content whatsoever. The more art it is, the more style it involves, the more individuality it involves, and the more authenticity it involves. So what we're, I guess, I'm trying to lever since 95, me personally, being a freelancer, doing an agency that is concerned about culture management, is to strengthen the creative, progressive art forms by getting some economical know-how inside and getting some technological know-how inside and getting some media know-how inside. So there's a lot of people in the audience that do that for years already, which is nothing unusual for you. But I think it's still good to remind that, that the roots of that making money is always the real space, the real topic of survival. How do I buy my food? How do I pay my rent? In creating or distributing progressive content. So there's other markets. I would say 80% of the world are other markets that have something to do with mainstream, that have something to do with scale, with economy of scale, that have something to do with international global attention, that have something to do with gigantic marketing budgets. I'm not talking about that. And I think it's, well, it's not boring to talk about that. It's very interesting to talk about that also, but I'm talking about the niches. And especially the niche of music in a city like Berlin is so incredibly fascinating. Since 2 years I'm doing a flyer collection with a collective of people who collect flyers that we're putting on tour through about 20 cities in Europe at the moment. What drives me to do that is basically fan-based, but it's strategic, of course. It's a fantastic method of seeing who's active where, which groups of people have a dynamic at the moment, which is interesting new stuff. I'm totally bored by normal radio. I like jazz radio, for example. I discovered since I have a Trabant and listen to jazz radio in Berlin on the ETA. But there's very small formats in Germany that are interesting on the air. So what I'm always looking for is either the live venue, which could be a concert, which could be a good club, where audio is combined with video, for example, where audio is combined with art or with installation, where audio is combined, above all, with people of the same interests and of potential mates. I don't know. That's probably the driving force behind it, I guess. So Berlin is a fantastic, it's like a Phantasialand or a Disneyland or a Expo 2000 all day long, all year long, for at least progressive styles. And I guess that's the image the city wants to transport, which brings me to another point. The funding in cities like London and Berlin, there might have been a tendency that the money has gone away from progressive culture forms, but there's a tendency also that the funding is coming back to those progressive culture forms as the city suddenly find out that there is an incredible potential for marketing worldwide to get 1 million people to Berlin once a year with the Love Parade, listening to techno. 10 years ago, nobody would have just slightly thought about an idea like that. So the 90s have been a media revolution era. Flyers would be an analog media revolution, I would say. It was a vast amount of wonderful, pretty papers being handed over one by one. One by one is an interesting statement here, too. It's a tool. It's an ingredient in the mix of cooking, maybe models that could give money to the people that fill them or that try to offer them to others. So one-on-one marketing is a very special possibility that internet brings. One to few is a possibility that the internet radio brings us. And maybe it's enough to have 1,000 listeners. And the listeners are getting such a high quality of good content and are being offered so many informations around that content. That could be a stream, that could be a download, doesn't matter. That just is enough for a couple of people to live on, and that makes sense. Curating the vast amounts of content definitely makes sense. The club radio model is a very strong model, I would say, and there's also competitors, or I would say people that have found out about the possibilities of that also, which is perfectly fine, which means go to the source and really amplify with a medium the quality of a real space, and that could be a gallery, that could be like a convention center like this or a club like this. So what we do is we install machines there, we install them once, then we have to go back a couple of times until they're like working on 100% level. But after that, it's a remote thing, mostly at least. Which means as soon as a DJ is putting on a record, it's possible to hear it in the world, which is a total interesting effect. By the way, dancing in a club like this is a very interesting effect socially. You just know that there's a couple of people listening. Could it be only 5? Could it be only 10? But it's changing. It's a little shift in togetherness. It's a little shift in synchronicity also. So I'm totally off what I wanted to say, basically, but go to the source is a real aspect about what we are doing. You were asking me, Manze, if we are paying the artists.
Important question, I think.
Well, if you consider the club bookers and the club makers, complex artists or gallerists, they get the shares from what we are doing, so they are partners, and they are paying the DJs. And occasionally it's happening, you have that experience also, that some DJs don't want to be broadcasted for business or artistic reasons, or they have a price, they name a price and say, wait a second, if you want me in the net, you have to pay for it. So this is changing the model again, so which makes us, in the role of being an amplifier, th- think about possible things, possible plugins, features like pop-ups with advertising, like in-stream ads, like chat formats, formats like we're only using Reel at the moment. We're thinking about including MPEG soon. But there's also the format of the show of 5 minutes, the show of 1 hour, or the stream of 8 hours. The interface, what kind of interface do you offer? How popular can it be? The database behind the whole system. Because we are generating, during the last 2 years, we produced about 1,500 live streams, which is rather many, rather a lot. If you consider every stream from every dance floor, from every PA as a product, that would be at least we are offering something in the market. There's nobody who's really like buying a stream a day, and maybe tomorrow I'll buy another stream. But I think there is a chance that this will happen. One of the things that I'm really speculating on, has something to do with economical background, I guess. I would bet on it almost, is that very soon, the exclusiveness of a stream is a very special topic also. Very soon there will be regional buyers of streams, like somebody in New York who's offering a bar and has to pay a DJ or has to provide his customers with a sound, might get the idea that he buys off a Trezor stream one night. And he does advertising with that. He does a flyer, Trezor in New York. No DJ there, but it's live from Berlin because it's prime time in New York when we start at 12 at night in Berlin. So that's a strange model of a regional market, that the receiving spot, to strengthen the receiving spots and to offer product for a receiving spot, for example, by distributing live production around the globe. Okay, I kind of lost the models, but I talked a lot already, and I think that's there's enough time for questions now and a discussion maybe.
Yeah, I'm hoping to have a lively discussion about this and get a lot of input from the audience. I just want to pose a question to the panelists first, though. What seems to me a qualitative difference between older forms of making media or making art, actually. Specifically performance arts, is that you have a physical venue that somebody goes to and pays for it. With a new digital media, you can copy that same material. Now, there's a sort of a shady line between what is art and entertainment, and people on the panel are sort of trying to provide both. But central to the business model of broadcasting, certainly radio broadcasting on the internet, of a way to raise money is through advertising. And as far as I can tell, it's not working as, I mean, I think Joe can talk a little bit about this, it's not working as people thought it was. And I think it has to do with the fact that the reason why it's worked in, let's say, television is because it's really much more of a mass medium. It's not as narrow cast as internet radio stations are. To be able to make money off a radio station, you basically have to be the Yahoo radio station, is my theory. You have to be one of the dominant. And I'm hoping to see that theory proven. And then the other question I want to pose is, and the other question is, I know you're not covering your cost through advertising. This is a fact. And I know that you probably won't be in 2 years. Maybe in 10 years you will be.
Maybe last week.
And then the other question I want to pose to specifically David is, you have the choice of putting advertising, but you. It's an issue of principle for you that your content it should not be for commercial consumer.
But just one thing that I want to say. It's because all the project I have seen, it's still dealing with the idea of chain process of distributing media. And what I tried to did with teleweb.org and some other project before, one project was to put music with a phone. So you just had a phone number, you call and you could answer it, put some music or talk or something like this, and it was immediately streamed on the web. What I try to make with this project is the idea of the self-media, so to push the system of the network until the end. It's like everybody is his own media. So in a way, you don't have to talk about some intermediate people. If you want to stream what you do, if you want to show what you do, you can do it yourself. And I think in a way or in another way, in maybe in 2 or 3 years, everybody will be able to do this. Every group, every... So in another way, it's very important that if you can stream your own media, that you can make some portal, public portal. And that's to answer to your question, why it has to be public. Because I know by experience already that if you begin with the idea of commercial, more or less at the end, the people will give you money for what you do. Or it's, for example, I went to see the guy of Real Video in France. So it was very funny. He said he sent me an email. He said, "Oh, it's very nice what you do. I want to see you." So I went to see to him, and he was horrible. He was terrible. He could say, you know, I could say fuck you to you. I don't say it to you. And in fact, he was saying it. But you have, there is maybe 400 people every day looking the website. So and adding something. So it's quite a lot for me, I think. But for him, it was nothing because that's what you say. It was a mass media. And so he said to me, "It's nice what you do, but it's not enough for me to put adverts or to something." But it was just testing him. I went there just to talk with him, and he was horrible. I mean, his talking was horrible. It was like, you know, we have 80% of the streaming things on the world, so I don't give a shit of what you do. In fact, it was what he was saying. Say, okay, bye. It's not a problem. But it was a problem that if. Maybe if he say yes, okay, I give you $1,000 a month to put an ad and something. At the end, I will be dependent of him. And with such a project or other project, I always try to find a way that to, in fact, to use the network as a free tool to stream and to put your content. So it costs me nothing almost. It costs me maybe $200 a month or something to do this. And I just share the knowledge I know from companies and from things. And I think it's very important to stay in this area of sharing things, of exchanging things, of making groups, of making public portals. So that was the idea of the public portal, which is without commercial. Of course, lots of people ask me to put commercial and they give me $10 on each click or on each I don't know what, but it's bullshit. I mean,
do you take donations as a public, is there a public institute or a corporation that takes donations, for example?
In France?
Yeah, I mean, if you had a non-profit organization,
yeah.
Would you be willing to explore the model of donations as a way to sustain a media project?
I think, okay, that's what you say. You need money for the material. It's free people.
For paying for rent.
It's people who are benevolent. So, okay, yeah. I need money. It's not that I don't need money to make some project. But in a way, if you go on the commercial way, you lose what is internet in a way. And one of my next project, I think internet is a trash now, it's commercial and all that shit. So one of the next project is to do another web and to go out of this, even, okay, let the www dot everything with commercial and go elsewhere and do something else. I think we really have to fight with this idea of commercial and of people putting money just to see a number of people looking. And it doesn't work. You know what's happened? I think in 2 years, lots of web TV in France, they fall. They get millions, and they get no people looking at it. Anyway, it's the same. I mean, they lie on the number of visits, they lie of everything. They get millions to...
A good example, France, you mentioned Canal Web. I'm doing consulting.
Yeah, yeah.
For Canal Web Germany.
Oh, yes, you know Canal Web Germany. Yeah.
For program development. And I just know the best running show for Canal Web France is... Okay, other than a Letizia Casta showcase chat for L'Oreal, basically. But the best running show or the best continuous show is the chess show.
Yes, the chess shows, I know. That's
interesting. That's really special.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what's happened now with Canal Web? Canal Web, it's a big company with web TV and all those things. I had some friends there, and I always refused to work with them. And some friends say, okay, we're going to work with them. And you know what they say now, because they get 100 million of francs of money, they say, oh, you know, there is not enough people on your channel, so you go away. And they phone me and they say, can you hosting me now? Because, so, and of course it's like this. I think it's a wrong attitude and a wrong thinking of what is internet to think you can have million with what you do also, yeah?
And also, maybe, Joe, you want to talk about, I just want to mention quickly, internet radio stations now, a business model is to try to package the type of content that they like and to try to sell them products directly as opposed to just advertising.
Sure.
That's more of a successful advertising model.
And yeah, but
taking information from the consumer, knowing their purchasing habit, is very important to having a successful internet radio station. Would you say that?
Well, yes and no. I want to go back to the point you made earlier about whether or not there's a, you know, a, if you will, a niche market that can evolve for internet radio or any kind of internet media. And I think that the answer is yes. The reality is that in the early days of television and radio, there were the same kinds of questions being asked. Will the audience emerge? Oh, you can read these great histories of radio in which they describe radio as something that only a geek can love because it's so difficult to use. And we're not talking about internet radio. We're talking about radio, crystal radio days. And in the end, what has emerged is, yes, admittedly, something that not very many of us want to listen to, but successful commercial models. Now, if you look at television, the same thing I think happened there with cable television, at least in the United States. I know that we have a different model of programming for cable, but we've got now hundreds of channels of television, all of which are bad, presumably. But we have quite a few channels of television in the United States. We have a gardening channel and a history channel and a cartoon channel and a comedy channel and, you know, sports. We have five sports channels and so on and so forth. And that's part of the same model, I think, that's emerging with internet media, is that you will see more and more of these types of things form, and that's part of what's been able to happen already, is that because it's not geographically limited, it's community of interest oriented. And in community of interest audiences, I think that it will be possible to create something like a cable TV model, if you will, a genre-based model around particular types of audiences that will be successful. Now, the flip side as to, you know, and this is an area where we can obviously get into great heated debate, I think it's crazy to think that art should be separated out and be a separate thing from commercial society. That you know, we all live in a commercial society. We're in a commercial venue. We bought coffee. We're buying cigarettes, whatever. You know, the fact that
you don't buy artists, okay?
Well, but someone made this point earlier that the more we segregate artists out from commercial society, the worse commercial society is. Duh. I mean, that seems so obvious that part of the problem is that artists are disintegrating themselves from commercial society, and thus commercial society is just declining in terms of its value, if you will, as a cultural medium. And
that's an interesting point. I'm going to open up to discussion.
Yeah, we should have more.
People want to have questions. Times.
However, I'd say that there's a number of other models. There's pay-to-view models. There's actually models in the United States where, and it may be worldwide for all I know, where you're being paid like one of these points programs. The more time you spend listening, the more points or dollars you accumulate. RadioForCash.com tried this. I don't know that they've been successful or not. The model that you're discussing of e-commerce, where the radio station makes a cut on each purchase through an advertisement on the station.
So it assumes a consumer society. So it will not work.
Yes. Well, I don't know if it's working or not, but that's also from traditional radio. There's a paid PI or paid insertions, and then there's performance-based advertising in traditional radio per inquiry. The other thing that I think needs to be explored more, and you brought this up, is sort of the membership model, the community radio model in the United States, mm-hmm. and the public radio model in the United States, while it may involve some government funding, is always augmented by local community support, people who purchase memberships for, you know, whatever, $50 a year. The radio station I worked at had a frequency of 88.5 FM, so they would sell a membership for $88.50. That was sort of their, you know, marketing campaign.
Yeah.
And that's actually a model that I think more artists should be involved with, especially on the internet, now that we have things like, and I know that there may be some international issues, but things like PayPal, where you can do email microtransactions. You know, if you like this DJ, send him a dollar right now, you know, and those kinds of things. Yeah. There's no reason that can't be done. And you were saying this earlier that, you know, it may turn out that there's a few people out there who like this particular thing. And there's examples more on the commercial side, like David Bowie and Todd Rundgren, who sell subscriptions to their new work. For $10 a month, you can get exclusive access to the new work by Todd Rundgren or David Bowie or whomever. And I don't see why that couldn't be the same. People who are viewing net.congestion on the net right now who can't attend in person. Do you like this kind of festival? Use PayPal to email them $10 or something like that.
So, all right, I get the point.
We implore you, send money now. This program cannot continue unless you send your contributions now.
Yeah, yeah. I think we put net congestion panels with advertising in between them. And I'm also interested in people's experiences with the issue of funding, artists who've had to deal with this issue. So. Anybody have questions or comments or want to share their experiences? And a debate, yeah, heated debate even. Yeah, yeah, I prefer that. Yeah, okay.
Just an open question. It's questioning advertising as a viable model. Like, I've read somewhere, and I don't remember where, that some advertising agencies are sort of worried about the web because it's kind of deflating the value. It's kind of proving, or possibly, that they're not really getting their bang for their buck out of advertising, because they can actually track how many people are clicking and how much, you know, the ad, the banner ad or whatever is pulling through. So finally, it's been said that a lot of speculation as to how effective television advertising was, and they could never really prove it. But they just assumed, and the big advertisers like Coca-Cola and whatever, you know, seem to be successful with their branding, but that on the net, it's not really working. Gaga, I hope you're nodding to confirm. I guess it's your experience.
I think that I'm not able to share specific experience that proves or disproves that point, but I think that we're headed in that direction where what advertisers want is proof of performance.
So,
the famous maxim of advertising is half of all advertising dollars are wasted. We just don't know which half. And that's been the model of brand advertising historically, is for Coca-Cola, just spend the money. Just put as much out there as you can. You know, I see a Heineken, you know, this, you see ads everywhere you go. You know, people wearing Nike clothes or whatever. Get the brand out there. Get the vision out there. Make sure people see your logo. There's no guarantees, if you will. Whereas now what advertisers want is more of a guarantee.
Okay, well, that's good for the big guys. But my point here is, like, I heard a statistic, I'm not sure, but it's like the majority of ad money goes to the top 10 websites, right?
Yeah.
That's what I...
80-20
that, something
yeah.
like 80.
80% of all the dollars are going to go to the
right.
top 20.
So the rest of us
get to fight over
working
the
with niche
20%.
Markets are going to have very tiny little bit of advertising. And basically, my question is, or my I think it's not going to sustain what we're doing. Advertising, niche advertising, is not going to pay enough to sustain our operations. And I doubt that this is the way to go.
We're talking about art, so it's always mixed production and mixed distribution and mixed financing. So you have to have a mix. That's the point. You can't just recover with advertising, I'm totally sure. Why does Philip Morris not go in the web? Where's Marlboro in the web? Have you found it? Well, it's impossible to have a real valuable brand in the web and to keep it and to... It's difficult. It's at least super difficult and dangerous.
But I just want to say over here, just like the web has proved its efficiency in terms of business processes in virtually every single business that has had the sense to turn to the web. So I think that can be taken without, as a given. Clearly, the problem that you raised is not one for the websites. It's one for the advertisers. It is, if this website, this is a niche website, it addresses a particular community. This community is not alone in the world. There are many such communities around the rest of the world. There are other websites that deal with them. If the advertising industry fails to have sufficient information about what's happening on the web, that's that industry's fault, and one day they will wake up and deal with that problem. They will discover that it's quite easy, really, to find where these common communities are and which are the websites which deal with them best, and go and put your ad distributed all over there. You don't have to give your ad only to the top 20 websites. You can distribute at a much lower cost, ads all over the world, with an efficient ad distributor. Today, there are only a few models for distribution of ads. And let me tell you, I've used them. They're pretty pathetic in terms of what they actually deliver. So I'm not surprised that the advertising and advertisers feel a bit pissed off about the low rates, click-through rates, etc., that they're actually getting. It's not surprising.
I think that the question of efficiencies in the marketplace is really what this is about. And the problem is that it's going to take time to evolve. Going back to that example, say, of like poetry, a poetry radio station, I think that the analogy may be better than the cable television analogy I was trying to use earlier might be trade publications. If you were to read a poetry magazine, you're going to see a lot of ads for pens and paper and maybe dictionaries and thesauruses and so on and so forth, whatever the products are going to be. But you're not going to see an ad for a dictionary or a thesaurus or a pen or paper in a mass media outlet. You know, that's part of the thing, is that some of these, it's, I would also equate it to the desktop publishing revolution, and you brought up flyers. And I think that there's some analogies that you could think of in some ways there, that, you know, the broadsheet has existed for a long time, but now we have this incredible proliferation of things like flyers, in part because of tools like this that have allowed more people access to it. Not only did we get a lot more great flyers, we got a lot more junk. You know, we got a lot more terrible newsletters with poor typography or whatever. But in the end, it's creating a broader and slightly more efficient marketplace. And I think we'll head that way with advertising as well, but it's not going to happen by Christmas, you know, or anything like that. So.
Okay, let's move the discussion a little bit to the audience.
What is wrong with the, traditional way of making money on the internet? I mean, not so long ago, people used to wonder how anybody would ever make money on the internet and why people were wasting so much time. Even then, it's not as if people didn't make money. What they got on the internet for free, for giving things free, was a reputation. And that reputation served you well in meat space and allowed you to make money as a consultant or as a supplier of goods or whatever. Now, the fact of the matter is that things on the internet work very well if they are free. And they do not work well if you charge for them, no matter how.
All services for free.
It's because people expect information to be free on the internet. I mean, I'd rather go to Boombox because I'm not going to be listening to advertising than I would go to GoGaga in some sense. It's also a viewership issue.
A distribution of costs. It's deferred costs. I mean, we live in a commercial society. Nothing in the end is free except for the actual, you know, thought of creativity, if you will. And even that is hindered and bounded by, you know, societal rules.
One further aspect of the internet is free. Of course, that's true. I mean, we all profit from it. We all love it because of that. A lot of the content is free. But who's making money with it? Cisco, Hewlett Packard, IBM, and the whole telecommunication world out there. They're making millions of billions of dollars. Go to the CeBIT in Germany. Check it out, what the market did during the last 10 years. Those people profit from the content that is freely delivered in and freely being taken out. Never forget that. I mean, streaming is pushing massive data transfer rates and bigger servers and everything. So there is always like the question of, is that justified to do it? Obviously. But obviously also there's a mix. There's a mix of creative content, of small, minor content, niche market content, free software, free hardware, interesting thing. Talk to redundant technologies or visit the doom scenario later. Where's the free hardware that the state gives to people? I guess it's an important issue in a country like India, maybe. And so there's such a lot of things for free, and they will stay there. They will not be, you cannot get them away there. But the thing is that some people that produce real content and valuable art or valuable music, music is a community service, and the musicians do it to play for the people, and they want to be heard. That's the first approach.
Yeah.
Sometimes they get the feedback that is good enough to make money with it, okay. So that's even better. But they will get some of the money, I'm sure.
There's some kind of dilemma. I mean, it's more like a philosophical problem that the net is immaterial. Coming from club culture, the DJs are getting paid basically by people drinking beer. And we didn't find the beer on the net yet. You know, and if this would be possible to find something like that for club radio, for example, then you would have a business model. But
free beer. You know. There's your business model right there, free beer.
Okay.
The idea popped up a little bit about micropayments. Can micropayments help for starving artists? Does anybody have experience with that?
Yeah, they can be a little less hungry.
Is it working yet?
It works. There's some examples, I think, of micropayments, and mostly it's not. I can't think of any really large-scale examples of micropayment systems that are working, but if you look at some of the...
Porno sites.
Well, no,
it's,
I mean...
Well, it's not real micropayment.
Yeah, I mean, there are the system PayPal from X.com. I think they get down to about a minimum of 5 cents. You can send 5 cents by email. Although...
What,
I don't know of and I also know that there were some things in the nonprofit world in the United States where they were working on doing contribution systems. There was even a company in Boulder where we're from called Epidemic Marketing that spent, I believe they spent something like 40% of their venture capital money on one 30-second Super Bowl commercial and then went out of business. However, their model was going to be that you could send emails to your friends and that you would put ads in your email, and the revenues from those ads in your email you were able to contribute to the charity of your choice or the nonprofit organization of your choice. So, you know, there's examples, but I can't think of any real successful proven models around that. Examples, anecdotal stuff, yes, but, you know, artists who are living off of micropayments, I don't know of any, you know, specifically.
I've had experience as a user with publishing. I've actually paid micropayments for being able to download an article off the web as opposed to having to go to a library and pull it from an old archive. And it's very little. It's something like 50 cents. I don't know if it goes to the author of the of the content, but that's one thing I felt comfortable doing in terms of a micropayment.
Well, and I think that there was kind of an implication about the subscription model, that, you know, subscription models don't work. And the issue there has to do with the value of the content. And likewise, while advertisers are questioning the value of their purchases or their expenditures on the internet, and that's driving the value, like, you know, banner ads are less than $1 a thousand, very commodity based. Right now, I think that there is an issue that content is seen as a commodity as well, and that's, again, comes back to the role of the artist. It's the role of the artist, I think, to make content that is not commodity content. And that's another one of these fundamental arguments or discussions or debates that, you know, we could have, is that, again, comes back to the idea that, you know, art is something that I think inherently is not commodifiable. Even if you're able to replicate it, duplicate it, transmit it, publish it, however you want to think of it, distribute it, it still is the fundamental element that is going to have value. And whether that art is music or visual art or writing or speaking, poetry, whatever, that's the key thing that I think artists need to be involved in commercial society for. They create culture. They create value. And then you have this additional value chain. And they're at the beginning of the value chain. And the rest of the value chain is things like distribution, promotion, Oh, well, that's fine.
I think you... It's really like you think like 30 years ago, you work in a new model of communication and everything, and you think art like 30 years ago also. You have to believe that...
500 years ago.
But you have to believe that artists also work with the structural things of internet and also try to change the way of distributing themselves, media, themselves what they do. And I think for the first time with internet, we can do this. So it's, you also have to think of this. It's not only like, okay, there is music, video, and paintings, and I am between, and I can show it, and I can find advertising for artists, and I can give them $1 each time or something like that. There is lots of artists working much deeper in what you say. So I think you're talking about art is totally old. I mean, what is art and what is not art? I think so.
See, actually, to get back to the historical, we wanted to lead on from what they were just arguing about. Till as recently as 100 years back, almost all art was paid for by the state in one form or the other. If you had feudal nations, it was the kings and the dukes and the barons and so on who actually supported art in their local areas. And this, was down to music, this was down to painting, sculpture. You name any form of art, and that's the way it was. Today, things are different. There are precious few kings left, but there are many so-called democratic states. Most of these democratic states around the world, as you've seen, advanced countries like the US don't have a clear budget for funding art in large ways, at least not for minor artists. Yeah, big artists get paid by the people, and everybody else can go starve. What I'm saying is that there hasn't been any replacement for the old state funding. In a big way, there's no replacement. Where you did have major state funding, you had all kinds of accusations of corruption and God knows what, like the UK has, you know, and a constant ferment about the way their Arts Council and so on worked, and whether the Tate modern is going to be bigger than the Tate old, et cetera, and, you know, and whether the Tate old is working hard enough to come up to the Tate modern.
Yep. In my local town, recently in the local raving mailing list, there was a promoter of a show who said free tickets, come along. And it seemed to be a marketing exercise as a way of them building up their database for the local and a way of raking it out of a local mailing list. Now, while they weren't streaming, the incident that caused the most trouble was the SMS spam that they then sent out to all the people that they'd gotten the mobile phone numbers from to then spam about the gig. That's lent me to think more about other styles of marketing, even particular about if a rave or a doof was on, that you could give the address out via SMS in particular. Or if you were starting a netcast, you can certainly advertise to the people that are on your membership that through the SMS, go to your computer, and it's on now, because that's a real issue when it comes to doing a netcast and getting audience, just getting them in front of the computer at the very time that you're doing it. My question is more particularly also about club radio and credibility within a community, and how do you start off with an online edge and build that credibility where otherwise the community will just call you cheese, is where I come from, and just cheese and not very good at all, like not a good reputation, and you won't be picked up by that community, which is the people drinking the beer and making the money. And
credibility, how do you build it up? I don't know. I can't count how many nights I spent in clubs during the last years, and lots of times I wasn't necessarily in the mood to do it, but there was a reason to do it, to meet people and talk about things, or to get the server up, or I don't know, to encode this or that. I don't know, that's...
Yeah, hello, I have a little question about micropayments. It seemed to come up and then was brushed aside quite quickly. Do you think that the reason micropayments aren't a major factor or used or successful is because the systems don't exist, or because as a concept it's not a good concept?
I think it's just too early. I think it's just too early to know if it's going to work or not. I think there are a few systems now that are in place that are functional, as far as I can tell, and it's more a matter of people beginning to use them, and whether or not they are successful, I think, has a lot more to do with user behavior and with marketplace acceptance than it does with whether or not the technology is going to work, because I think the technology is going to work. That doesn't seem very difficult.
I think it's the question of what you can offer and what the customer wants. If he wants like high bandwidth, top quality, exclusive, he has to pay. If he wants mediocre quality with no video, I don't know. Maybe it can be dealt with micropayment or abonnement system. A lot of it will still be there for free. That's for sure. But like, if you want more, you can pay more. Micro more could be more too.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks
Thank you.
For the panel, and thanks for the audience.